Radio. I'm Mike Vaccara at the White House. A sailing organization reports it looks like a yacht involved in a race off the coast of California and Mexico was slammed by a much larger vessel, and that it's possible the bigger ship didn't even realize anything happened. The Coast Guard is still looking for a missing crew member, but has found three bodies. High winds and hail caused havoc in St. Louis as a beer tent where 200 partygoers were gathered was swept away. NBC's Katie Turr has more.
There are three still in serious condition. Two are in critical, and one man is dead today. This after 50-mile-an-hour winds.
The group was gathered yesterday to celebrate a St. Louis Cardinals win. Today marks 20 years since the Los Angeles riots were sparked following the beating of Rodney King and the acquittal of the police officers involved. Former South Central pastor Reverend Cecil Murray describes what his part of the city was like two decades ago.
When I went outside the church, there, an inferno.
This is NBC News Radio. Many are shocked following the apparent suicide of a Washington State man who was believed to have killed his wife and daughter. Peter Keller was found dead yesterday in his bunker that he spent 8 years preparing in the foothills east of Seattle. His former co-worker, Paul Cook, says he was stunned when he learned the details of Keller's life.
This person that we thought we knew turned out to be somebody that had a whole other side to them, and we can't make any sense out of it.
Authorities had spent a week looking for Keller. A prominent Iranian lawmaker is adding to the war of words between Tehran and Washington. A semi-official news agency quotes the lawmaker as saying the reported basing of America's most sophisticated stealth jet fighters in the United Arab Emirates is a U.S.-Israeli plot to create regional instability. One analyst says even a year after the U.S. raid that killed Osama bin Laden, it's wishful thinking to believe al-Qaeda is close to defeat. U.S. officials say the terrorist organization still aspires to inflict another 9/11-style attack. More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Mike Vaccara, NBC News Radio.
Every so often, the stars are in perfect alignment, and during the Lincoln Certified Pre-Owned Sales Event, now is that perfect moment. For a limited time, get 0.9% APR on the Certified Pre-Owned Lincoln of your choice, which comes with the confidence of our 6-year, 100,000-mile comprehensive warranty. The Lincoln Certified Pre-Owned Sales Event, exclusively at your Lincoln dealer. APR varies by term. Not all buyers will qualify for Lincoln Automotive Financial Services Limited Term Financing. Take delivery from dealer stock by 4/30/12. See dealer for qualifications, limited warranty, and complete details.
Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry has two special Mother's Day gift sets from Pandora.
That's Jared!
Purchase the cherished Mother's Gift Set, a bracelet, two sunburst clips, the mom charm and charm of your choice, only $200, a $235 value, and the Pandora Iconic Bracelet Gift Set. Bracelet, two S-clips and charm of your choice for only $140, a $160 value. Available April 26th through May 13th while supplies last. Charm of your choice valued up to $35.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth here on 1500 AM every Saturday at 10 AM. Please join me this week for my special guest, George Cranwell, president of GE Cranwell & Associates, and my partner, John Dedon, to talk about the Arlington real estate market. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
Adobe Acrobat Pro is actually used very commonly for PDF archiving. If you've got a lot of files of different formats and different types, if you just save these files into all these different formats, then 20 years later somebody wants to look at the file, they'd actually have to have the program that could open up that file. So for digital archiving, you'd rather have a standardized file format.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Hey, Jamie, who sings that song? Whoa, piece of bread.
That can't possibly be a real song.
No, it is. We heard it on the car radio this morning.
Matt, we really need to get HD radio so you can hear song lyrics better. Actually, we should get a Kia Sorento with the Yuvo infotainment system and HD radio. This way you can hear all your corny lyrics with crystal clear digital sound quality, and I can listen to good music on all the extra FM HD2 and HD3 stations it offers. Now sing that song again to me.
Whoa.
Voice-activated Yuvo infotainment system with HD radio. Now available in the Kia Sorento.
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show with some big news.
On Sunday, April 29th, we will be live at the Birchmere. We'll be there for the Carpenter's Cook-Off. It benefits the Carpenter's Shelter, a fantastic charity, and many of the area's best chefs are going to be there cooking it up.
That's Foodie and the Beast live this Sunday from the Birchmere at 11 on 1500 AM.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Dondi Saunders of Clifton Larson Allen, and we've got a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Kaz DiMaggio, co-founder and managing partner of the Tari Group, Mike Cardesi, co-founder, president, and CEO of Global Network Services, John Campagna, president, Military Intelligence Support and Operations, Chiniga Federal Systems, and Sue Chodakiewicz, president of Tetra Tech AMT. So let's get started. I'd like to introduce to you our first guest, a gentleman by the name of Kaz DiMaggio. Kaz is the co-founder and managing partner of the Tari Group. So Kaz, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What is the Tari Group?
Well, the Tari Group is a firm that provides technical support to mostly federal government clients to protect the U.S. population against weapons of mass destruction, like chemical, biological, nuclear weapons.
Can you give us a specific example?
Sure. One of the things we do is we help the federal government manage a system that is deployed throughout the United States in major cities that is actually out there looking for evidence of any kind of terrorist attack using biological weapons like anthrax that they might release into the air.
And your role in that is what?
Well, we actually provide quite a wide scope of support to the federal government. We help them manage the system day to day, but we also help them determine what should be included in that system, what sorts of technologies, yeah, what sorts of response activities should result if the system were to indicate that there was a release of something like anthrax into the air.
Yeah. So a perceived threat like anthrax or something else serious, so what is that, once every 5 years, 10 years, or are those things happening more often than we know?
Well, the threat is real. I wouldn't say that that kind of a release is something that is periodic in nature. We're very, very concerned about the intent of terrorist organizations and also rogue individuals who are intent on creating havoc in society, killing a lot of people in the United States through the use of biological weapons.
Yeah. Has that threat gone down at all over the years, or is it every bit as serious now as it was back in during 9/11?
Oh, I think it has increased. It really, the indications are that people are still very interested in the use of biological weapons. Not necessarily through the release of something like anthrax in the air, but it could be through release of biological agent in food products, in water. I mean, there are any number of ways that they could do that.
So those threats are more significant today than they were 10, 12 years ago?
Yes.
Wow. How big or small is your company?
We're about 150 people right now.
And your co-founder, you co-founded the company when?
In 2001.
Okay. First of all, thank you for doing such important work. And secondly, why did you co-found the company?
Well, I was looking for an opportunity to create an organization where one could really speak the truth, and do some analysis, and be true to that analysis. And I didn't find that in my previous experiences.
What do you mean, speak the truth?
Well, most of in my experience in both the federal government and in private sector had handcuffs associated with it. In the government, you're constrained beyond saying things for political reasons. Yeah. In many of the organizations that I worked with in the private sector previously, you are constrained because of the potential negative impact on revenue.
Right.
I wanted to create a company where we could be more free to do the analysis, present it at face value, make recommendations on that, and in all honesty, if we had clients that weren't interested in getting that, then those weren't the right kind of clients for us.
Is that a risky approach to your company?
It's absolutely a risky approach, but it's interesting. It has worked well for us. It has become part of our brand.
Is this something you saw yourself doing growing up?
What I saw myself, I never assumed growing up that in any line of work that I might do that you might have to compromise your principles. And so it's not so much that I saw myself creating a company growing up, but I thought these kinds of venues would exist, and I just was not satisfied with those that I had involvement in.
So before you started this company, you felt like you were compromising your principles?
I did at some level, not necessarily to large detrimental effect, but I wanted the freedom to be able to go further.
And what does it feel like to have that kind of freedom now?
Well, it feels very satisfying professionally and philosophically to be able to do that. And it's interesting from a business perspective because it presents different kinds of challenges. One needs to seek out clients who are interested in that, who can handle that kind of advisory support.
Have you ever had to tell a client you can't handle the truth?
Absolutely. In fact, there was one memorable occasion very early after the 9/11 attacks. There was interest in looking at ways that we might protect the U.S. population from any kind of biological terrorism. And it was a joint program between the Department of Defense and the newly created Department of Homeland Security. And there was a disagreement between the two as to how to proceed. And one party decided that they knew exactly which way to go. And we had done the analysis and determined that that was not the right thing to do. And I was brought into my client's office, the door closed, and they said, "Kaz, I'm really sorry to tell you, despite your best efforts, we're going to have to go another way." And I looked right back at him and said, "Okay, John, but understand that by saying that, you're firing me because I'm not going to do it."
Wow. Wow. Congratulations for having that kind of backbone.
Well, it paid off in the end. We ended up being allowed to go forward with the approach that we took. It worked quite well, much better, in fact, than the alternative would have. And at the end of the project, after a very public meeting that included local officials, federal officials, military officials, that particular program manager came up to me and said, "Hey, I owe you an apology and a thank you for sticking to your guns."
Wow. Is this the kind of work your parents did, and this is where you learned these lessons?
No, it is not at all the kind of work my parents did. My parents... grew up without college education. They were more in the blue collar areas. My dad initially a meat packer, then a screw machine operator. My mother a key punch operator for a bank.
And what sort of ethic did they pass on to you?
That you should always work hard. Work hard to get ahead, and also do the kind of work that mattered.
To your dad, if I understand it correctly, that was working with your hands. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Tell us more.
My dad was very big on practical education. He had, of course, had always worked with his hands. He just assumed that his children would do the same. And it was very valuable from one perspective. I mean, growing up, my dad always had me at his side whenever he was going to fix something or build something around the house. I learned all of those skills. I learned the satisfaction that comes with building something yourself. But it was really, really not where I had intended to go with my own life.
Kaz, you had mentioned in the green room a night in a space observatory brought something to mind. What was that?
Well, I originally started college with the intent of being a space scientist. I entered school in an astrophysics program, and I was really enamored with space. To this day, I am still. The name of our company is a space reference. The Torrey Group comes from Torrey stars, which are early stage evolution, bright young stars. But that night in the observatory was very telling to me. I was all alone through the whole night, cold and dark, and not a soul to talk to, and I realized that that just wasn't for me.
You also mentioned something about not being on the right path at a point in your life and going on a camping trip. Is there a story there?
Well, actually, it's a follow-on to the night in the observatory. I knew that I was not destined to be a scientist, at least the type of scientist that was more involved in crunching numbers than working with people. And I needed to change course in my degree program in order to position me for the kind of work I did want to do. And so I went out on a camping trip by myself in the middle of nowhere in a day when there were no cell phones. There was no way to really tell anybody where I was, how I was doing. And I also happened to have my right hand in a cast at the time because I had broken my hand a few weeks earlier. I spent that whole night contemplating what I really wanted to do with my life and what I needed to do in order to accomplish that.
And so what happened?
Well, I came away thinking that what was best for me was to stay engaged with the sciences, but to pursue an education that also brought in more people skills and also more problem-solving kinds of analysis activities. So I went back and actually worked with some faculty members to create my own degree, a combination of astrophysics and geology, and went on and got a master's in science policy analysis.
You've come a long way from your parents, especially your dad working with his hands. What do your parents have to say about your success?
I think they're very proud of where I am today. My parents, when I entered school, when I entered college, both of them had been unemployed through a very bad period in our economy at that time for the better part of 9-10 months before I entered school. So they knew it was going to be a struggle on me to do what I wanted to do. And looking back, they're very proud of what I've been able to accomplish.
As well they should be. Would you please give us the web address for the Torrey Group, please, Cause?
Sure. It's www.torrigroup.com, and that's spelled T-A-U-R-I-G-R-O-U-P.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Kaz DiMaggio. Kaz is the co-founder and managing partner of the Torrey Group. I'd like to thank my co-host, Andy Saunders of Clifton Larson Allen, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like Kaz. And Dondi and I will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Amanda Teedy.
And Amanda, who are you with?
I'm with Cassidy Turley, and I represent tenants on their commercial real estate needs.
But that's not what you're here to talk about today, is it?
No, it's not.
What are you here to talk about?
I'm here to talk about the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and their Man and Woman of the Year campaign for 2012.
Yeah, give us the organization's name again.
It's the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society.
And what is that?
So this is an organization that helps families and doctors. Basically, they're raising a lot of money and resources in order to help these people who are finding out that they have been impacted by these terrible blood diseases.
And they have nominated you for what?
For the 2012 Woman of the Year.
Wow, congratulations. What does that mean?
Basically, it means this is in relationship to the National Capital Chapter, and it's basically a massive fundraising campaign. So I'm spending the next 10 weeks trying to raise as much money as we possibly can, and we have a pretty lofty goal of $100,000.
What inspired you to accept this nomination?
You know, there were a few things that really hit home for me. There was a blog going on late last year. It was the Patrick Kelly blog, and he was a guy who was, you know, 1 year ahead of me at JMU. He was 34, and he passed away. He lost his battle from lymphoma brain tumor, and he left behind his wife and his 2-year-old daughter. And it was pretty heart-wrenching.
You mentioned you had a goal. What's the goal?
The goal is $100,000.
By when?
By June 16th.
How are you going to achieve that?
Fortunately, I've organized an amazing team of people. We've got this great board who they're all, you know, business leaders and phenomenal people, and they're helping us get there. We've got several ways to do it. We've got a very great way to do it with this BizGravity website, bizgravity.com. We're able to auction off CEOs.
So what's the web address for us to find you?
One way to find me is by that one. It's BizGravity, GRAVITY.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Amanda Teedy, who is being nominated as Woman of the Year for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Joe Applebaum of the Potomac Companies, and we are pleased to introduce to you our next guest. This is John Campagna. John is the president of Military Intelligence Support and Operations for Chiniga Corporation. So, John, welcome to the show, and what is Chiniga Corporation?
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. Chiniga Corporation is an Alaska Native corporation. We are a professional services provider largely to the federal government, specifically within the Department of Defense and the intelligence community.
Can you give us a specific example of what you do?
Within my strategic business unit, we provide professional service support to, for example, the services, Army, Navy, Air Force, some agencies within the intelligence community in the form of engineers, subject matter experts in areas of cultural linguistics, perhaps subject matter experts in area that have to do with intelligence collection, processing, analysis.
So the average citizen like me is better off? How so?
In the sense that we are able to provide expertise from the military community, from the intelligence community, the joint private sector, and put them back in to support the federal government and the nation.
So I'm safer?
Much safer.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. How big or small is your company?
Chiniga Corporation is just about 6,000 employees. My strategic business unit is just under 1,000.
What is an Alaska Native Corporation?
An Alaska Native Corporation is we're formed as a result of ANCSA, the Alaska Native Lands Claim Settlement Act, 1975, I believe. And it's a program within the federal government that basically gives Alaska Native corporations some attributes within the federal acquisition regulations to do contracting with the federal government.
John, can you tell us and explain, maybe clear up the misconceptions about the Alaska Native corporations and how that works?
Gladly. The Alaska Native corporations, the sense is, or the misconception lies largely in the fact that some large business and small business feel that the Alaska Native corporations have an unfair advantage within the federal acquisition space. The misconception lies that most companies are either held by shareholders that get dividends within, for example, Fortune 500 companies, individuals that gain wealth and gain, you know, the benefit of the business that those companies do, and also other small businesses, 8A companies that also are individually owned. Alaska Native corporations are community owned. They're a community based program that provides the ability for Native Alaskans for self-determination, for self-sufficiency.
When you say they're community owned, what do you mean by that?
Villages, for example, Chiniga is a village corporation. Chiniga is in Prince William Sound. It's a village corporation. The residents of the village are the shareholders of that company. I am not an Alaska Native. I'm Italian. I work for the organization, have worked for 13 years, and I have zero equity in the company because I'm not a Native shareholder.
So the village in Alaska is better off how as a result of this company being created?
So the successes that Chiniga Corporation has enjoyed over the past years is the money that we make for them goes back to the community. The community gets it in forms of dividends. We also provide the ability for them to set up college funds, cultural preservation projects. When I joined Chiniga Corporation 13 years ago, I think there may have been three or four shareholders that actually had college degree. Now we have a large number of shareholders that have undergraduate degrees. We have four or five master's programs. We have a couple that are in PhD programs. So we're providing the benefit to the community by giving them the ability to expand in their education.
Do any of the shareholders, after they've been through college and grad school, have they ever come back into the business?
That's our goal. Our goal is to bring them into the business. We actually are the Chiniga Corporation CEO, Charles Todemoff, is a shareholder. He was the first member of the shareholder community to get his master's degree.
That's awesome. So that's awesome.
It's
work.
A good story.
Thank you.
And the program works.
Absolutely. Now, you've been president for a year and a half. Why you?
I've been president of this strategic business unit for a year and a half because that's when we created the strategic business unit model. Why me? Largely because I think as I've been in the organization for 13 years, I was given opportunities throughout the course of that period to to stand up capabilities within the organization. My focus is in the military and the intelligence community services arena. Chiniga Corporation is a fantastic organization for promoting from within. So they gave me the opportunity to, they gave me as much rope as I needed to either hang myself or build a hammock.
Well, there's lots of people who are qualified and probably have similar qualifications to you. Let's dig a little bit deeper. You value standing up for the oppressed. Is that a fair statement, or am I putting words in your mouth?
No, that's a very fair statement. I left the federal government. I was in the armed forces in 1998. I left the Army. I was a member of the Special Forces, Special Operations Community. Our motto is De Opreso Liber.
Say it again.
De Opreso Liber.
And that means what?
Free the oppressed.
How do you do that? Or how did you? Give us an example.
Well, as an example, when in service, we would go into areas. I spent a lot of time in Central America during the early 80s. We would go into, for example, El Salvador, working with Salvadoran military against the guerrilla, at the time an oppressive guerrilla regime that was trying to take over the country. We helped the villages in up and down some of the remote areas in El Paraiso, Santa Ana, in areas like that. We would help defend the area. We would show them how to defend themselves. We would show them how to fend off enemies and in essence, help them take care of themselves.
Occasionally, I will hear people in the military say, I joined because, you know, I wanted to get in the jungle, get in the theater, and shoot somebody. It sounds like your motivation is much different than that.
My motivation was a sense of service, the ability to really help those who couldn't help themselves. It's the old adage of I can't stand bullies, so I'm going to help people defend against bullies. I really enjoyed that when I was growing up. I was fortunate that I had friends and family that instilled that mentality in my head, and that's what I took throughout my adulthood.
In what way did your friends and family instill the value of standing up for the oppressed and not suffering bullies?
Probably the largest influence I've had in my life was a combination of three people had a huge impact on my life. My father, his father, my grandfather, and my uncle. All three taught me the value of self-sufficiency. All three taught me the value of a good, solid work ethic. All three taught me the value of standing up for those who couldn't stand up for themselves. And it's been ingrained in my culture since I was a kid.
Have you ever been in a situation where you couldn't stand up for yourself, or have you always been self-sufficient?
I've always figured a way out of not being in that situation. There are times, you know, many times when, you know, perhaps you find yourself in a situation where it may appear insurmountable, but with a little bit of common sense and a level head, you can figure a way out. Problem solving is something that I've always enjoyed doing, and it's instilled in us within the military and the special operations community.
Being former special forces, you've obviously been in some very difficult circumstances. What's the hardest thing you've ever had to do?
The hardest thing I've ever had to do, probably take a life, was the first thing. The first time I ever did that was...
Tell us about it.
Well, that was a situation in Central America. We were in a small village. Unexpectedly, we were attacked by a force that was overwhelming at the time, and bullets start flying. So you got to defend yourself. You got to defend your buddies, your teammates. And when you fire back, sometimes you take a life.
When bullets were flying, were you scared, or were you just such in the moment that you felt no emotions, or did you feel something else?
Training took over at that point. It's just a mentality. You know instinctively what to do. So we all had areas of defense that they had to fall back to.
Yeah.
We had everybody had their roles and responsibilities. When you're operating in an environment like that, you rely on your training. You rely on your teammates' training. So you hope that it pays off.
So how was it hard to take a life?
Well, taking a life is, I mean, that's not for humans to do. Taking a life means that you've taken somebody's son away, or somebody's husband away, or somebody's child away.
So there came a point when you were out of training mode and you could reflect on that a little bit more. Is that correct?
Yeah, in the moment you don't think of it. At least I don't recall that I thought of it. You know, frankly, I can't think that I ever thought about the implications at the time. But afterwards, you think about it because it has an impact.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you've taken somebody's life. They're no longer walking the earth. You've had something to do with that. So it's difficult.
What sort of legacy would you like to leave behind, whether it's through your special forces work, whether it's through Chiniga Corporation? What type of legacy?
I'd like to leave behind the notion that what we do matters. that the people that we help, the organizations that we support, the lives that we influence for good.
I can see how you've done that for people in Central American countries. I can see how you're doing that for Alaskan Natives. One of your goals in starting the company was to give a place for retired military to continue to serve and have meaningful lives in contributing. Tell us just a little bit about that.
That was a big motivator for me to work for a company like Geniga. When I left the service, the first job I had for a very, very short period of time was with a company that really didn't think of the implications of people who provided a service to their country, how their life would continue to be in private sector. Yeah. I was very ill-prepared for it. So one of the things that I set out to do very, very quickly, and at the time that I actually went to work for Geniga, was to establish what we called a soft landing zone for teammates that were leaving the service. Yeah. Former members of either organizations that we knew or former service members, from any service for that matter, have a place that they could go and still provide and matter. What they were doing was valuable and appreciated.
Would you give us the web address for Geniga Corporation, please?
www.geniga.com.
Would you spell it for us, please?
Chenega.com.
Fantastic. I appreciate that, John. We've been speaking with John Campagna, President of Military Intelligence Support and Operations, Geniga Corporation. I'd like to thank my co-host, Joe Applebaum with the Potomac Companies, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, just like John. And we will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is...
Mike Harden.
Mike, who are you with?
I'm with Vistage International.
What is Vistage?
Vistage is by far the largest and probably the most prestigious organization of CEOs in the world. We have about 15,000 members in 16 different countries.
And what does Vistage do?
Vistage is there specifically to help people get better at what they do at the CEO level. Our goal is to help CEOs become... better decision makers, to grow their businesses, to do more with what they've got.
And what do you do at Vistage?
Well, I'm a chair with Vistage, and a chair simply means that I chair a local group of chief executive officers, and I coach each of those people individually and try to make myself available to help them with their business needs.
Why is coaching so important to a CEO? Don't they have it all figured out?
I wish they did. I'd been a CEO myself for a long time, and I wish I'd had a coach. There's just too much going on in today's world. You're being pulled in all kinds of different directions. You're making decisions every day, and it's just so isolated for some people to have to make those decisions without the ability to go to other people.
There's a plethora of coaches out there. Why are you a fantastic CEO coach? Why you?
Well, I would say that what I do is I help good CEOs become great CEOs, and what I do with that is I have certain axioms of business that I try to stress, and one of the first ones is that you deserve the people that you hire and keep.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, if you have A players on your staff, they're going to do a great job for you, and you deserve to have them. If you have B players, well, then you deserve to have B players.
So you're looking for what type of person?
I look for CEOs who are lifelong learners, who want to be better at what they do, and need someone like me to help them get there.
How do we find you, Mike?
Well, I have a blog, and most CEOs look at it. It's called CEOSuccessCoach.com.
We've been speaking with Mike Harden of Vistage and CEOSuccessCoach.com. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Andy Saunders of Clifton Larson Allen, and it's our pleasure to introduce our next guest. His name is Mark Cardesi. Mike is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Global Network Services. So, Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And tell us, what is Global Network Services?
Global Network Services is an IT services company, web applications, IT services, application development, and that sort of thing.
Can you give us a very specific example of what you do?
One of the things we do is a case management software for the Air Force, where we make sure the folks who are putting in a case, somebody who feels that they were harassed or something wrong with what the way they were been treated, that their process has been taken care of in a quick and efficient manner, and that they feel like they've been taken care of. Honestly.
So if I'm in the Air Force and mm-hmm. I've got an EEO case right. about me, what are you doing for me?
I'm making sure that you're getting adjudicated properly. I'm making sure that any of your rights are being taken care of on the civil side,
yes,
and the military side, that you're following military justice.
Wow, that's important work. Thank you for doing it. Mm-hmm. How big or small is your company?
We're just under $10 million.
And you're the co-founder. When did you co-found the firm?
1996.
Well, why'd you do that?
I had an issue with authority. And I had a...
Such as?
I had a director of IT who didn't know anything about IT, and so my suggestions kind of fell on deaf ears, and I felt that it'd be easier for me to go out and do this kind of a job on my own.
So lots of people have authority figures who, for some reason, don't measure up, but they don't all start companies. Well, why you?
I just thought it'd be easier. I wouldn't have to deal with a boss and that sort of thing, and it turns out I was wrong.
How so?
Well, it turns out that every customer in the world that I have is my boss. So instead of getting away from bosses, I multiplied them by an exponential number.
So how is it easier now to deal with many bosses than just one boss before?
Well, I'm always trying to give that value add, or the value for value kind of work for the IT services. So it doesn't matter how many bosses you have. You're always focused on what you're trying to do is the right thing from a technology standpoint, and it's what we decide is the right thing.
You wanted to do the right thing when you were young. You had an example of that?
I did. When I was in middle school, I was on the bus with a buddy of mine, and he defaced one of the bus seats, and being the outgoing person that I am, everybody knew who I was but didn't know who he was, and we were brought down to the principal's office, and the principal and the security officer were in one room kind of, you know, throwing the spotlight on me and giving me a lot of pressure on giving up my buddy, and I couldn't do it.
Why not?
It's that you know, you're a kid, you've got buddies, you don't want to turn your buddy in, you want to do the right thing, but on the other hand, you don't want to be a rat or, you know, give up a friend.
Did your buddy think that you'd rat him out, or was he confident you'd keep your mouth shut?
Oh, I'm sure he knew that I'd keep my mouth shut.
Yeah. So what happened?
Well, while I was in the office there, and under this the spotlight from the principal, I actually asked to talk to my dad, which kind of threw them off, because that was one of the things that they used to try and pressure kids and to give them information.
So are you sweating bullets, or are you cool as a cucumber?
No, I'm sweating. These two guys are yelling at me, and well, yelling's not proper, but probably raised voices and trying to pressure me into giving the information, because, you know, they're the principal, they're the security officer, they're going to get the information out of me.
So you get your dad on the phone.
So I get my dad on the phone, and I tell him one of my buddies, quote-unquote, had done this, and I knew who it was, but I didn't feel right about giving it up. Of course, he knew immediately, since he knew all my friends, he knew immediately who it was, and he asked me, and I said yes. And he said, well, why don't you go talk to your buddy? I will get these guys off of you for a little while.
So your dad's on the phone, and you
Correct.
Handed the phone to the principal.
Correct. He said, let me talk to the principal, and I'll let them let you go.
What'd your dad say?
He told them that my son's going to go talk to the boy who did this, and he's going to see if he can get him to turn himself in.
So what'd you do?
I handed the phone over. I went down. I talked to my buddy, and my buddy was good enough that when I told him that I got caught for it, I didn't tell him that he was on the ropes or anything. But when I told him I got caught, he was willing to turn himself in.
They let you off the hook?
They let me off the hook totally.
What does that say about you, Mike?
Well, I mean, it was really an issue about my dad, who had my back no matter what. Even though I was involved in this, I wasn't doing it directly, but I was still involved. He supported me, and he didn't throw me under the bus or my buddy under the bus. He let me try and figure this out with him.
Did you know your dad would have your back?
You know, in the back of my mind, I did. I mean, I knew that I could always call him, and he'd always give me the right answer.
Was there another time that happened to in your life with your dad?
Well, one of the other times would be when I was just out of high school, and I finished all my honors courses, and I'd been working really hard. It was the last my senior year, and I, at the end of the year, had this job. It was a $8 an hour job, and I knew that was a lot of money back in the '80s or mid '80s. And I went to him and I said, you know, I'm not going to college. Even though I got accepted, I'm not going to college. This is what I'm going to do. And my father didn't give me a hard time about it. He just said, okay. And then at the end of the summer, when I woke up early one morning and met him at the door as I was leaving, he said, where are you going so early? And I said, I got to go register for classes. And he never gave me a hard time about it. A couple of years later, I asked him about it, and he said, well, I knew that you'd do the right thing, a summer out in the sun working working out laboring and that sort of thing would teach you that working with your mind is better than working with your back sometimes.
So what characteristics do you now possess as a result of your dad or these experiences?
Well, education, number one. More education is always better. The more I can, I'm always learning. As you know, a company owner, you're always trying to learn new things, trying to get advisors, that sort of thing. But secondarily, supporting my people, supporting my family, and always basically having their back.
Mike, you have a commitment to community service and are being awarded for that here in Fairfax County. Can you tell us more about that?
I've been involved with the Northern Virginia Technology Council's foundation since it was a committee back in 1997. And all of that work, I was noticed earlier a couple months ago. The Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce asked if they could nominate me for their service award for Executive of the Year. And I said, okay.
You probably get some pretty good PR out of that, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And I've shied away from a lot of these kinds of awards. A couple people brought them to me and said I should self-nominate and that sort of thing. And I don't like that sort of thing. I'm doing this. Most of the stuff I do is for kids, and I do it because I enjoy kids, and I want to try and help my community.
Yeah, in the green room when I started to talk to you about this stuff, you would barely give me any information about it because you wanted to be so low-key. Well, why is that?
Yeah, I just I've always wanted to, since the start of my company, I started in 96. I started giving back to the community in 97. That's always been a part of my life, and I do it because I love doing it. The enjoyment, what I get out of it is I get to see these young folks do better or get more education or learn something.
So just you and your company is devoted to community service or other people as well?
No, I really try and push everybody to be involved in the community someplace. They don't have to do that, but I try and do it by leading, and I try and bring them involved with the things that I'm doing, my pet projects, or they can or will support their projects.
What's the hardest thing you've ever had to do, Mike?
The hardest thing I had to do was fire the first person that I hired in my company when I started.
So back in 1996, there were how many people to start?
I started with one person.
Just you and this other person.
And a few years later, I ended up having to fire that person.
Okay, well, tell us about that.
Well, I had this kind of utopian idea of how I was going to run a company. Kind of very transparent, very open, everybody's in essence a partner in the company trying to make the company do better and go forward. And it seems that just wasn't going to work. I mean, I tried, and some people have just a pure employee mentality, and you know, they didn't want to do those extra little things the customer needed. And I've always been a kind of a value for value kind of person. You're going to pay me, I want to make sure that you get the value out of it. And if it means that I have to stay a little bit after or I have to put a little extra into it, then that's what I'm going to do.
So how'd you do it?
How did I fire him?
Yeah.
I took him to a restaurant, and I sat down, and I said, here's the issues, and we're going this way. This is what my vision is. This is the direction we're going in, and it doesn't seem like that's your vision, and we need to part ways.
How did he or she respond?
Just total dismay. I expected some kind of anger or fight, yeah, or something like that, but there was just a kind of a look like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that you did this.
How did that feel to you to make that decision?
It took me a month once I realized that was the direction I had to go in to make the decision. It took me a month, and then once I had decided to do it, it probably took me 2 days to get up the courage to set up the schedule, just because I brought this fellow in, and I'd known him for years beforehand, and we had a great relationship, and he was an older fellow. He had taught me some stuff, and now I had to let him go. It was terrible.
You mentioned early in the interview that you started your company because you have a problem with authority. You're in authority now. It doesn't sound like you have a problem using it wisely.
I try and do the most correct thing at each crossroads, and I think about it as much as I can to try and make the right decisions. I can't say that I've always made them, but I try my best.
Would you give us the web address, please, for Global Network Services, Mike?
Sure, www.gogns.net.
Okay, let's do that again. I want to make sure everybody catches it slowly this time, please.
www.gogns.net.
fantastic. We've been speaking with Mike Cardesi. Mike is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Global Network Services. I'd like to thank my co-host, Dondi Saunders of CLA, Clifton Larson Allen, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like Mike. And Dondi and I will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight.
Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380 or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Joe Applebaum of the Potomac Companies, and Joe and I are thrilled to introduce to you our final guest of the day. Her name is Sue Chodakewitz, and Sue is the president of Tetra Tech AMT. So, Sue, welcome to the show. And tell us, what is Tetra Tech AMT?
Well, Tetra Tech AMT is the organization that really focuses on IT and aviation management for Tetra Tech, our parent company, which is a $3 billion environmental and engineering firm worldwide.
What does aviation management look like?
Great question. Think about it this way. The federal government and many other international organizations and commercial firms are seeking ways to increase the capacity of the skies. And what that means is coming up with new approaches, new procedures for how planes can take off and land while remaining safe.
The capacity of the skies, at least to this unlearned person, seem pretty big. Why is that an issue?
You would think so, right? But when you think about the astronomical rise in air traffic and what it means for the economy and security and everything else, there really are major congestion areas, if you will, especially around the large cities. So what the government and commercial industry is doing is finding ways around that, building new highways, in essence, but they're in the sky.
And that's what you do. Highways in the sky.
Exactly.
Safer.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
So to make everybody's life a little easier.
Where are you from?
I'm from New York City.
And what was life like in New York City growing up?
It was great.
How so?
Well, I think that from a lot of different perspectives, you get enormous ability to see diversity, to experience new things. You get to see the world and spread your wings.
So when the interview's over, I know Joe, my co-host, is going to say, so we're in New York City. So I guess I got to ask you right now, we're in New York City.
Save him the time later, in Astoria, Queens.
And what is that like in particular?
Well, it's changed a lot, I'm sure, but it was in many ways a neighborhood. It was very proximate. Obviously, it's part of New York City, but you can get to all the touristy and all the activities you want. But it was a neighborhood, and it was the best of both worlds in many ways.
So this is not like high-rise Manhattan, and your father was like Donald Trump, and you're living in a penthouse somewhere.
Well, no, that would be a whole different story to tell, apparently. But it was high-rise, but not like Donald Trump's high-rise.
so tell us about your mom and dad.
Well, both of them were wonderful people. My father worked for the federal government. My mom was a teacher. They really instilled in us an incredible recognition to do the best we can to give back to the community and to really stretch our wings.
So you just said parents, wonderful people, give back to the community. Your mom was a teacher. Those two things kind of fit together. What did your dad do?
My dad worked for the IRS.
Most people do not connect IRS with helping the community and wonderful people. Your dad was different, or is that just a misconception about the IRS?
Well, perhaps both. I won't talk about the overall organization right now, but from my dad's perspective, he felt that the IRS in general, and he in particular, had a really important job, which was to ensure individuals and companies were accountable, to hold them accountable if they did not act properly, but if they did act properly, to make sure they got the recognition and attention of operating in the right mode.
That's not usual. How does that, you know, go with today's economy and people's impression of the IRS?
Again, that's obviously a very large question, but I think the fundamental perspective is he felt his personal charge was to make sure that people followed the rules and that they did the right thing. And he took that very personally and took it very seriously.
Did you ever have to stick up for the fact that your dad worked for the IRS?
I did. I mean, my brother and I laugh because first you had to defend, you know, your mom for being a teacher, and then you had to work on this side as well. But again, I think it was a good example, right? I heard my dad many times explain what it meant to him and why he was doing it and why he was proud.
Yeah. In the green room, you told us all about your mom and dad, and then you said, I was raised to be that way. When you say that way, what does that mean?
In essence, it means don't shy away from controversy. It means say the right thing. It means stick up for what you believe in. And it means to defend what your choices are.
From what you told us earlier, you were a big proponent of that. You actually defended friends and other students. And how did that go?
Well, I've never been accused of being shy. And I think it started at a young age. I think you learn very important lessons when your core values are tested. And if I was taught to stick up for what was right, then that led me to being vocal when I thought things were not going in that mode. And so I did get in trouble. I remember one time very early on in seventh grade when someone was accused of doing something wrong that I knew was not the case. And really the entire focus of the discussion changed and I got in trouble. And I was asked to apologize and I wouldn't. And I spent many days in the detention hall.
Was it worth it?
It was worth it because I think you're tested very young. And I think if you break form in terms of core values early, it's very hard to get it back.
That example you gave, to be a little more specific, you felt a teacher was bullying a student. Is that right? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Right. So there was one individual I remember clearly who, no matter what he tried to do, was not good enough or right. I felt that he was held to a different standard and that, you know, it became a spiral, a downward spiral, that the more he tried to do what was right but got blamed, he could never catch up.
Now, why were you not on the teacher's side, given your mom was a teacher?
Because my mom said, teachers are like everyone else. They are not born right. They earn respect. And they are judged based on who they are as people and how they operate. And in this case, the individual, not the teacher, but the individual that she represented was wrong.
You told us in the green room, speaking of your mom, that she taught you, quote, the most important thing you can do is speak your mind, end quote. How did your mom do that and live that?
She taught me, I think, interestingly, as I reflect on this, she didn't model the way in terms of her professional career, because being a teacher was pretty standard. It was traditional at that point in time. But what she truly did was work with me, I think, in a very conscious way to consider alternative approaches and alternative scenarios and ask me to think about how I'd feel if I reacted one way rather than the other.
So how do you use those lessons that you learned at an early age from your mother today in business?
I think the most important applicability is really to operate as a team, to have transparency and collaboration, to ensure that you've got the right people sitting at the table, and to ensure that you listen to them. I once had a boss who said that nobody should be fired for what they say, they should be fired for what they don't say. And I think that's very true.
Your mom, you mentioned, took a very traditional career route. As did you, Russian studies and intelligence work. So, you know, all jokes aside, what did it feel like to be the only woman, probably at times, in the Russian studies class or in the intelligence community? What did it feel like?
It was interesting. And again, I have my mom to thank for this in many ways. I think I alternated between being blind to the fact that I was different and unique because I just focused on competency. Either I should be in the room because of what I knew, or I shouldn't be, but the gender issue shouldn't come into play. Alternatively, you know, there were times when I was getting ready to do a briefing and people would ask me to go get the coffee. So it was an interesting juxtaposition.
So your mom seeing you have this career trajectory where you're the only woman oftentimes, was her attitude one that she was kind of blind to it? She just said, well, of course. Or did she have the, you go, girl, you're making a big difference here. What was her reaction?
Her reaction really was, if you're happy and this gives you professional satisfaction, then it doesn't matter what anybody else at the table looks like.
You mentioned a big turning point in your life, Sue, was when you went from government and nonprofit to private industry. Why was that such a big turning point?
Because I really had to delve deep into my soul to decide if that was abandoning the values and the concepts that my parents had taught me.
Was it?
I don't think so. What I realized as I grew and matured is that there are many ways to give back, and how you operate as a leader, how you support the government, these are all different ways, different paths for the same end.
Did your parents embrace that decision, or did you have some explaining to do to them as to why you were making the switch?
I think that my mom embraced it because she trusted my instincts. My father was concerned that this would be too risky, it would be too much of a stretch. It wasn't so much the moral decision part of it as it was the environmental factor.
You did say something about stretching yourself, didn't you, in the green room?
I did. It's interesting in the sense that watching my parents, who were in relatively safe positions, I determined that they might have been able to do more exciting, challenging things if they took risks. So I decided very consciously that I would apply that to my career path.
Excellent.
Would you give us the web address, please, for Tetra Tech AMT?
Absolutely. www.amti.com.
Give it just one more time.
www.amti.com.
AMTI.com. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Sue Chodakewicz. Sue is the president of Tetra Tech AMT. I'd like to thank all of our guests today. Kaz DiMaggio, co-founder and managing partner of the Tari Group. Mike Cardacy, co-founder, president, and CEO of Global Network Services. John Campagna, president of Military Intelligence Support and Operations for Chiniga Corporation. And, of course, most recently, Sue Chodakewicz, president of Tetra Tech AMT. I'd like to thank my co-hosts today, Dawn D. Saunders of Clifton Larson Allen and Joe Applebaum of the Potomac Companies for helping me with the interview. More than anybody, thank you so much to our listening audience. If it wasn't for you, we would not even have a radio show. So thank you so very much for listening. I'd also like to thank the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce for hosting us. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our leaders like Sue and our other guests today. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, your host. Again, thank you so very much for listening. And until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or